The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Welcome to a Wednesday. We're at the midway point of the week. Still a long ways before the weekend, but we'll get there, I hope. Welcome to the show. I need to start today with a correction, because occasionally even I get things wrong. I try not to, but once in a while, you know, yesterday I was telling you about Kathy Hochul. She's the lieutenant governor of New York, and chances are pretty good that she will have to step up and fill out the remainder of Andrew Cuomo's term, because there's no way he can stay in office. As you heard yesterday, the Attorney General of New York, Letitia James, released the report that was, 4 months in the making, after a lot of allegations of sexual harassment claims against the governor, which he poo-pooed and said, you know, let's have an investigation. And I thought that was the right thing to do. So you have an investigation. Well, the investigation was completed, and Attorney General Tish James, announced it yesterday, and it was pretty damn devastating.
The independent investigation has concluded that Governor Andrew Cuomo sexually harassed multiple women, and in doing so violated federal and state law.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, the investigation found that Governor Andrew Cuomo sexually harassed current and former New York State employees by engaging in unwelcome and non-consensual touching and making numerous offensive comments of a suggestive and sexual nature that created a hostile work environment for women. The investigators independently corroborated and substantiated these facts through interviews and evidence, including contemporaneous notes and communications. This evidence will be made available to the public along with the report. This investigation was started after a number of women publicly alleged that they had been sexually harassed by Governor Cuomo.
Yep.
And on March 1st of this year, the governor's office made a referral to my office pursuant to State Executive Law 63-8 regarding these allegations.
So Governor Cuomo yesterday, after the announcement by Attorney General James, was shocked, I tell you, so surprised. How could any of these women that I touched, that I made suggestive remarks to, that I got uncomfortably personal with, how could they ever have thought I did anything wrong? I learned that from my parents. I kissed everybody. And then he played this really kind of creepy slideshow. Well, again, I'm sort of going in a roundabout way to apologize for bad information I gave you yesterday about Kathy Hochul. I was correct in that she is a very blue doggy type Democrat. She's what I call a conservadem. She comes from a conservative part of New York. In fact, here's the real story. Forget what I told you yesterday. I remembered that was the story, but I fabricated some great tale. What happened? Kathy Hochul, now Lieutenant Governor of New York since 2015, was elected to Congress from New York's 26th congressional district. She won a four-way special election to fill the seat vacated by the Republican Chris Lee, who did something sleazy and creepy and had to resign. So she was the first Democrat elected from that district in 40 years, which explains why she's kind of blue doggy, because she's in a conservative district in upstate New York. Now, yesterday, I got her mixed up with Kirsten Gillibrand. I was thinking that she took Gillibrand's House seat when Gillibrand was named to the Senate to replace Hillary Clinton when she became Secretary of State. That is wrong. I was wrong. I'm Nicole Sandler. I somehow misremembered something, and I was convinced yesterday. I'm just reeling off these facts like I remembered them, and I must have been high. Not yesterday, but when it happened, I don't know. So anyway, I apologize. Kirsten Gillibrand represented New York's 20th congressional district. She was first elected in 2007 and only served a couple of years because then Governor Patterson, David Patterson, named Kirsten Gillibrand, Congresswoman, to fill Hillary Clinton's Senate seat. That part I got right. That's when Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State, but it had nothing to do with Kathy Hochul. I think I just lumped them together because they were two conservadem women from, you know, upstate New York. But anyway, once in a while, I get things wrong. That's why I wanted to correct it. Thank you to John, listener John, who corrected me on Twitter. It's like, oh, shit, I'm going to have to do a mea culpa there. So, yeah, so I screwed that one up. However, Kirsten Gillibrand, once she got into the Senate, has become immeasurably more progressive. Do not confuse that with me saying that she is progressive. Gillibrand is far from progressive, but she's more progressive leaning in the Senate than she ever was in the House, representing a conservative district. So Kathy Hochul, do I have any hope that she'll be better as governor than she was as a congressman? Well, not necessarily, but I don't know a whole lot about her. We'll talk to Howie Klein tomorrow about Kathy Hochul. Not that he knows anything more. And I don't know, you know, Lieutenant Governor of New York doesn't get a lot of responsibility. It's sort of like Vice President. So I don't know, but I guess she'll be better than Andrew Cuomo, which isn't saying much because he's a slime. He is the slime on the TV screen. Anyway, so that's the first thing I needed to talk to you about. So got that out of the way. I apologize. I hate giving out wrong information. Usually when I reel it off from the top of my head, I'm pretty confident that I know what I'm talking about. And I usually do. Again, yesterday I was wrong. So there's that. Next story. Elections in Ohio yesterday. I don't know what happened. Well, I know what happened. That faction, the conservadem faction, the establishment of the Democratic Party, pulled out a big victory. Nina Turner, who was a Bernie Sanders surrogate, who has been with Bernie, like at his side since he first ran in 2016 for president, she had come from Ohio where she was a state senator, and she lost her bid for re-election or for a higher office. And then she just really became a Bernie Sanders surrogate. And thing I love about Nina Turner is how outspoken she is, that she says what she thinks. You know, you're not left to wonder, what did she mean by that? Because she says what she thinks. And in fact, it's one of those things that probably cost her this election. When she first started running, I mean, when the election began, she was she was in the lead. I mean, she had like a 30-point lead against anybody else. Then the establishment faction said, we need to get one of our people in there. And they convinced this woman who was a Cuyahoga County councilwoman to run, and she won. Her name is Chantel Brown. I for some reason I have a block on her name, Chantel Brown. I need to write it down so I have it here. Well spoken, beautiful woman, and most importantly, a big Joe Biden supporter. You see, and Nina Turner didn't make things any better last night with her concession speech, where, and I didn't pull audio because I'm not going to play it for you because it's frustrating. She basically blamed evil big money, evil big dark money for her loss. Well, first of all, Nina Turner outspent Chantel Brown, but it's where it was spent. Chantel Brown went at Nina Turner with attack ads from the get-go, and a lot of dark money, a lot of money that's not accounted for, a lot of money that we don't know exactly where it came from. Nina Turner outraised her with grassroots contributions, but they pulled out the, you know, the Jim Clyburn, Hillary Clinton, you know, Hail Mary pass, and spotlighted this statement that Nina Turner made about, I'm going to paraphrase here, something about Joe Biden being a shit sandwich. And even if you only take a little bite of it, it's still shit. She said that. They put those words on billboards. They ran them on TV commercials ad nauseum. Of course she was going to lose. I don't know. And I'm not in Ohio. So if somebody's there and wants to call in and correct me, please do. Number is 954-889-6410. And Connie Schultz, by the way, happens to be Mrs. Sherrod Brown. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning newspaper columnist and author. And she's brilliant. She's really smart. And what she said was that this just tells you that all of these politics is local. This was a local race. And despite all the national attention on it, and of course the media pressure saying that this is the future, this is going to show whether the progressives, you know, are in charge of the Democratic Party or, you know, they're the also rans. I don't think it says anything of the sort. I think it says in Ohio's 11th district, the people with a lot of urging from Jim Clyburn and Hillary Clinton and the Democratic establishment and a lot of dark money, you know, they voted for Chantel Brown. The other thing is turnout was anemic. I mean, it was something like, I don't have the numbers in front of me, I apologize, but it was like, I think she won by 6 points. So it was like 51 to 46, right? I mean, it wasn't that close, but it wasn't that, you know, it wasn't a blowout either. And Fantoma says Chantel Brown is corrupt. And it's very possible. Again, she didn't run on her fitness for the job. Her campaign was based on saying, you don't want Nina Turner. That's an angry black woman. That's a woman who will challenge Joe Biden instead of being, you know, a reliable yes, sir, vote for him. You know, I like Nina Turner, but I understand why she scares some people. She's a tough woman, and she doesn't suffer fools lightly. She says what she thinks. Maybe that's why I like her. But she scares some people, and especially the Jim Clyburns of the world. So, of course, they're taking a victory lap saying, see, we put those damn progressives in their place. It's all up to us. Ugh. Meanwhile, interesting polling today. Let me see if I can't find. I think I flagged this tweet because I found it so interesting. Here it is. Tweet from Sahil Kapoor, who said, big bright spot for Joe Biden in the new Quinnipiac poll. His infrastructure proposal is supported by 65%. Disapproving, 28%. Now that is a margin, right? And so that's the so-called bipartisan deal. That's the one that's they're dealing with in the Senate right now. The other part of it, the $3.5 trillion package on social programs, what do you think? What do you think the approval rating of that bill is? $3.5 trillion package. Thinking about how the you know, the right-wing noise machine you know, talks about it. You know, it's a socialist giveaway. Well, you know, they'd be wrong too, because the number, the 62% approve of the $3.5 trillion package, the one that will pass by Democrats only through reconciliation. 62%, 32% oppose. Thinking back to the 4 years that the orange guy was in the Oval Office, nothing he ever did was supported by 62% of the American people. Just saying. Can't think of anything. And his approval rating never got above, well, certainly never broke 50%. So there's that. But wait, there's more. There's more going on. Before we get to our guest, I should tell you who our guest is today. This is an interesting guy. You know what we're living through now. We are in the midst of climate change. We're in the midst of all those things that they've been warning us for the last 20 or 30 years were going to happen. The rising sea levels, the warmer temperature, the more destructive fires and storms, and you know those 100-year storms are going to start popping up every year. Those things that were fantasy, that were off in the future, well, they are here now. We are living through them. If you're in the Western United States, you're on fire, or there's fire all around you. You know, you're here in Florida. Well, the sea level is rising. Buildings collapse. You know, shit like that. So our guest today is a climate activist. His name is Daniel Sherrill. And he's been dealing with climate change his whole life, knowing that it's his generation, his contemporaries, who are going to have to do something about it, because the generations that came before him left this mess for them to clean up. So he wrote a book. It's his very first book. It takes the form sort of a letter to his as yet unborn child, whether one is going to come or not, we don't know. But and it's called Warmth: Coming of Age at the End of Our World. So we'll speak with Daniel Sherrill in a little while at the bottom of the hour. But before we get to him, I have a few other things. All right. So when we last spoke yesterday, we knew that Joe Biden, the administration, was going to announce some kind of extension of the moratorium on evictions, right? It was in place. What the problem was, well, it was a number of things. Back in June, the Supreme Court didn't exactly say, no, the CDC can't put a moratorium on evictions. They just said, you know, they threw up some red flags. They didn't pull down the moratorium that was in place, but they did sort of let it be known that future such actions could only be taken by Congress, that Congress has the authority to do that, not necessarily the CDC. Well, Congress fucked up. They didn't do it. And the House is already gone on vacation for 7 weeks. Yeah, which obviously makes me angry, but that's a story for another time. The Senate's still there, and the Senate is working on the infrastructure stuff, but nobody touched the eviction moratorium, which expired Saturday night at midnight. And thanks to Cori Bush, junior freshman congresswoman from St. Louis, who has experienced homelessness before. She's been evicted before. She knows what is happening to families all over the country. And so she's doing an action, a peaceful protest. And she said that she is not leaving. A lot of her colleagues left D.C. She's still there, and she set up a chair and some stuff on the Capitol steps. And she has been there since Thursday, refusing to leave until something is done to help these millions of Americans who are about ready to be thrown out on the street with nowhere to go, and the COVID pandemic raging yet again. It would have been one thing if we were still on the downswing where it looked like we maybe had beaten this thing and there were, you know, hospitals without any COVID patients. Well, that's not the situation now. Hospitals are once again filled to capacity. Here in Florida, we have more new cases of COVID in one day than ever before throughout the course of this pandemic. The hospitals are full. They've already stopped allowing visitors in. It's getting back to where it was at the height of the worst of it. And we have a vaccine now. So this is on the people who refuse to get vaccinated. So long story, still long, but the CDC yesterday did reenact, I guess, I don't think that's the right word, but put back in place a targeted eviction moratorium in the places where the outbreak is surging, basically, where people, even those who've been vaccinated, are being told to wear a mask. And it's for 60 days. But Joe Biden says that should, look, this may be challenged in court, but it'll at least buy us time to get some of that money that's been allocated to renters and landlords alike. This is a problem in the states. The federal government allocated the money and I guess distributed it to the states. It's the states that haven't sent it out to individuals in need. States need to get on that. Now, again, I live in Florida. I don't expect that'll happen. Here in Florida, moving on to the next story, our idiot governor, moron, death sentence, late last week said, there will be no more mandates, no masks, no lockdowns, no closures. Kids are going to go back to school without masks. And here we are in Florida where things are, you know, exploding. I don't leave the house again. That's how bad it is. So I live in Broward County. I told you this. Broward County is just above Miami. There's Miami-Dade with Miami. There's Broward County with Fort Lauderdale. And then there's Palm Beach County. These are the three most, the bluest parts of Florida. But Broward County School Board met. One meeting was shut down because there were parents who were, you know, DeSantis and Trump followers, I guess, who were making noise. But finally, the Broward County School Board said, we will have a mask mandate. Kids go back to school in 2 weeks, and every student, every teacher, and every staff person in those schools will have to wear a mask because we put our kids' safety first. Moron death sentence comes out and says, there will be no mask mandates in my state. I don't believe in science. And so any school district that puts in a mandate will lose funding. He threatens to pull state funding from the public schools in any county that, you know, is trying to protect their kids by saying they've got to wear masks. So that was Friday, Saturday. In yesterday's paper, is this yesterday or the day before? I don't know. This is the Miami Herald. Yes, I do subscribe to a newspaper. Broward School District backpedals on mask mandate after DeSantis says he'll cut funds. This is blackmail, actually. And our kids are the fodder. Broward County Public Schools backtracked on its mask mandate Monday, saying the district would comply with the governor's executive order that prevents schools from requiring facial coverings. The district said in a statement Monday afternoon, Broward County Public Schools intends to comply with the governor's latest executive order. This came just days after, last Wednesday, the 9-member Broward School Board unanimously voted to require masks for all students, teachers, staff, and visitors at its schools after the U.S. Centers for Disease Control said on the same day that all students, teachers, staff, and visitors should wear masks inside K-12 schools. It's pretty simple. If you follow the science, it makes sense. So school board made the unanimous decision, said, I don't care what the governor said. Well, but then the governor's like, okay, well, then I'm going to cut your funding. And then the Broward School Board says, well, damn. Well, shit, what are we supposed to do now? So they did backtrack, but let me read to you the headline from today's Miami Herald. Broward Schools says mask mandate still in place for now as it reviews DeSantis' order. Any way the wind blows. Sorry. Just 2 days after saying it intended to comply with the governor's order prohibiting mask mandates in school, Broward County Public Schools has announced that its mask mandate will be in place until further notice. So take that. The school board is expected to discuss next steps during a special meeting on August 10th, about a week before classes resume on August 18th. And right now, Broward doesn't even have a school superintendent because the guy who was in there earning something like, you know, $900,000 a year salary or something obscene like that was caught in a lie about something and he was ousted. But of course, he got paid off the bulk of his contract before he left. So they're in between school superintendents right now. But the district is quoted in a statement saying, in light of the governor's executive order, the district is awaiting further guidance before rendering a decision on the mask mandate. Again, welcome to Florida. I see we still have a few more minutes before our guest gets here, so let me keep going. Former President Barack Obama had a big birthday party planned for this week. And I think today's his 60th birthday. I think today is his actual birthday. But he was supposed to have like 500 people at his mansion on Martha's Vineyard. Pearl Jam was going to play. Really? Pearl Jam was going to perform at Obama's birthday party. And everyone from Oprah to Spielberg and beyond was expected to attend. And now, today, he said, you know what? We're going to cancel it. Sorry, COVID, all that stuff. So, you know what? In that spirit, I'll take one for the team, too. Today's August 4th. My birthday is 3 months from today. How did that go so fast? 3 months from today, I'll be 62. I'm going to cancel my birthday party too. So Bruce Springsteen, you don't have to come. You don't have to play live at my birthday party. I'll just deal with it and tell everybody not to show up. Taking one for the team. Because COVID, right? Okay, and then, so at least people don't have to get on a plane to fly. Because, well, we know, right? We know what goes on in the friendly skies. They're not so friendly anymore. I'm going to play for you a short video that somebody recorded above on board a Frontier Airlines flight. It was going from like Philadelphia or Pittsburgh, somewhere in there, to, go figure, Florida, right? It was coming down here. Oh, David. Okay. Hi, David.
Hi, this is David, an angry white man calling from Coral Springs, Florida.
Yes. What's up, David, my husband?
So, Trump has these fucking, and you know I'm not the biggest fan of Barack Obama.
Right.
But nonetheless, Trump has these fucking Nuremberg rallies all over the country where thousands of people show up, several of them indoors. No one says boo.
Right.
Obama, who, and I think it was ill-advised, wants to invite 500 people who will all be vaccinated.
Who will all be tested for COVID, and tested.
Screened
True.
To his private place, and it's a fucking capital crime.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, aren't you proud of me for canceling my birthday party 3 months in advance?
Well, if you didn't do it, I was going to. I had Pearl Jam, you know, on notice that they may not be
Bruce,
required to show up here.
Obama was having Pearl Jam. I was going to have Bruce. And so I already told him, it's like, Bruce, you don't have to come. You don't have to perform for me for my birthday.
Well,
it would be really nice, but, you know, he doesn't have
You'll have to deal with Bruce. I don't have any line.
Gotcha. All right. Well, let me go finish this story before our guest gets here. And because I
love you, Matthew. Bye.
Love you too. Bye. All right. David, everybody. All right. So anyway, so as I was saying before we were interrupted, Frontier Airlines, a flight from Pennsylvania somewhere to Florida. And this happened. An unruly passenger, go figure. Well, here's some of what happened. And got to the point where he was so abusive and grabbed one of the flight attendant's breasts or something that they duct taped him to his seat. Here's video.
You guys fucking suck. My parents
His parents have $2 million. Okay.
Yeah.
Really? Okay, so this guy, and now it's a little later, and he's still mouthing off, and the flight attendants are there trying to calm him down. Now he's flailing and going after them. And the flight attendants are trying to subdue him, and they duct taped him to his seat. Right? They are duct taping him to his seat. Okay, so that happened. Got it? So that was Frontier Air. Big to-do about it. And so they land in Florida. The guy's arrested. But the flight crew, who I think did the right thing, did the responsible thing there, they were all suspended. Like, why? They were great. So, well, now we have a spokesperson. You know, it figures that the spokesperson always comes out. So we have a spokesperson for, I'm just trying to get this, this video, a spokesperson for Frontier Airlines, who made a statement today, because, you know, when something like this happens, you need to hear from the spokespeople. So I think this spokesperson's name, go figure, is Blair. Spokesperson for Frontier Air.
Thank you for having me. You know, here at Frontier, we say we have low fares.
Oh, no. Hold on. Give me one more second because I realized that I don't have any audio on the video for that. Give me one moment and I will add audio so you can hear what Blair, that's all of a sudden a very common name, isn't it? So what did Blair, the spokesperson for Frontier Air, have to say? Let's start over. Okay, take two. Take it away, Blair. Air.
Thank you for having me. You know, here at Frontier, we say we have low fares and high customers, and that is especially true when you're on a flight to Florida, which is where the plane was going. So we can't say we are surprised by the events that transpired. You know, the thing about the skies is that they are lawless. There are no laws up there. And therefore, there are no laws on our planes when they are in the sky. Our pilots are not licensed because they do not have to be because they are in the sky where there are no laws.
Oh, my.
So anything can happen when you get on one of our flights. You know, uh-huh. We're just glad everyone made it back safely. And that's what we always say here at Frontier. When a plane lands, we go, oh, thank God, you know, because we're Frontier Airlines. And we don't really know what's going on. I will say that the flight attendants are heroes, and that is why we suspended them, so they can get a little break. It is unpaid, but so just have a little break, a little self-care time, because whew, it's rough up there.
It's rough up there. Again, Frontier Airlines spokesperson Blair Erskine. Boy, she's on a roll. She was yesterday was she Andrew Cuomo's spokesperson? She pops up every now and then. She's hysterical. Talk about low-key, really funny. That's her. All right. Our guest should be here by now, and I don't see him yet. So let me make sure I don't have an email from them saying that there's a problem or anything. All right. Well, this is the problem. When I have a guest coming on, like through Zoom, and I send them the link, double sound? You have double sound right now? You shouldn't have double sound right now. I'm a little thrown off because, again, our guest is not here. So I'll tell you what, let me find something that I can share with you while I try to figure out where he is, because he should be here by now. So I think I gave you the Frontier Air, I gave you Blair, I gave you all those. All right, I'm going to play just because we all need to be reminded that we need to mask up because COVID is back with a vengeance. I will play you one of my funny songs about, you know, maybe getting vaccinated. That would be a good thing, right? If you haven't been vaccinated yet, I don't know what you're waiting for. Let's see if this works. I don't know if it will. I should have been prepared with filler in case the guest wasn't here. Well, we'll find out quickly, won't we? Maybe we have a song for you.
Ready?
Yep.
Okay. How was that?
When are you going to put it in?
Speed up, inject me fast. I need an antibody blast, so
Come on, ram that needle home. Need a vaccine, so give it to me. Ba-da-da-da-da-da-da, give it to me. Hey there, Fauci, what you knowin'? How's the vaccine program going? Ain't you got no shot for me? Do it and do-do, give it to me. Ba-da-da-da-da-da, give it to me. Hey, Joe Biden, tell the nation, screwed by Trump's administration. Need to find some more vaccine. Find it quick and give it to me. Ba-da-da-da-da-da, give it to me. Got no fever, no coughing, no trouble with sleep. The test found no virus, doc ain't said a peep. So load that syringe up and plunge it in deep. Vaccination, give it to me.
Sorry about that. I turned up the wrong thing. I meant to turn down the other thing. I think that's the parody project with Give It to Me, the vaccine, that is. I'm still waiting on the guest. You know, and they confirmed with me earlier today, so I don't know what the problem is. Here's what we'll do is, I guess it's a good time to call in. Should you care to make a comment about anything, have a question, a statement, or maybe we may just have to call New York and do some random calls to New York and ask people what they think about of their governor, Andrew Cuomo. I guess we could, because honestly, I have nothing else planned, because our guest is supposed to be here, and still no response from the publisher. This, I hate this. From now on, I have to get a backup phone number. Oh, here, let me shoot him a message. She just sent a note. Okay, so I'll tell you what. I didn't plan for this. Usually, if I'm going to make a phone call to a place to check on a news story, I'll get some numbers. Oh, there's somebody calling who's saving my ass. Ah, it's from I think from Minneapolis. Hi, hello. Is this Roger?
It is.
Hey, Roger. How are you doing?
Pretty well. How are you?
Perturbed. A little perturbed that my guest isn't here, but aside from that, doing okay.
I have many sources of perturbation as well.
Yes, mm-hmm. I understand.
With regard to the Cuomo thing, I feel like we really are allowing the media to do an end run around us again. They pick up a bone like this and run with it and go wall to wall with it. And it's embarrassing to watch. I understand that Cuomo abused his position of power to make some women feel uncomfortable and possibly went well beyond the bounds of propriety. But it saddens me to see so much of our attention being drawn to this matter right now when we have important other things to worry about.
Yeah, right. I mean, we do have other things to worry about. And this, you know, this is frustrating. And especially, as I said yesterday, pisses me off because Mario Cuomo was such a great man. And somebody that I was fortunate enough to know personally, who I really respected. And I feel like his son is tainting his name.
Well, there is truth to that. And I had great regard for Mario Cuomo. I wanted him to become president.
Me too.
And I was very disappointed that that didn't go further. With regard to the pandemic, I don't know how you can live in Florida at this point. I don't know how.
Well, because it takes money to move, and that's the problem. And where do you go? I mean, it's not like there are great places to go that are affordable. That's the conundrum. If we had money to move, where would we go? We can't go up north because my husband is allergic to the cold. I'm not a big fan of snowstorms in the middle of winter either. It's what keeps me happy here in Florida, like in February when the rest of the country is digging out and we have, 80 degrees. But I could deal with it. I've lived in snowy, cold places before. But I honestly don't know where we would go. I don't, because the whole world is crazy. The whole world is insane right now.
Well, there's California, Oregon.
California's too expensive. California's too expensive. I kept my house there, that would have been one thing, but I can't afford to live there. Oregon is on fire, as is Washington State. But you're right. And it's getting warmer, so it's not like it's going to be freezing cold there, I suppose.
I actually think that you guys might want to consider either Portland or Seattle neighborhood. Yes, it's a bit expensive, but it's not filled with Floridians. I'm in Minneapolis. I can't recommend, for an urban environment, I can't recommend anything more highly than living right here. But I'm in the process of going right back down into full bore lockdown.
Uh-huh.
Just like I spent most of the last year.
Right. Well, you're in Minnesota. That's way too cold. Could never, ever live in Minnesota. I don't know how any warm-blooded person does. It's cold there.
It can be. We get our fair share of gorgeous weather, I must tell you. And oddly enough, the amount of truly cold weather that we get isn't all... It's certainly far less than it was. I grew up here, and I remember when we would have three week periods when it would be when we would scarcely see a day where we had a high above 0 degrees. We would get 3 weeks in a row of lows of 20 below below.
Yeah, no. Yeah, that's not going to happen. Hey, Roger, I'm going to run just because this is interesting to you and me, but probably nobody else. So, and our guest is here. Our guest is here. Our guest is here. So let me go talk to our guest. All right. Thanks, Roger, for filling the time. Okay. So I see our guest has arrived. Daniel Sherrill is his name. Let's get his shot together here so we can chat from it. He saved me from calling. I was actually going to call a hotel in New York City to find out how they're dealing with the, the news of Andrew Cuomo. But Daniel has arrived, so he saved me from that possibility. Let me just bring him in because we are late. So getting my shot together. Sorry, that's why I'm fumfering here.
No problem.
Because I do, I'm the producer, I'm the engineer, I'm the cameraman and everything else. So Daniel Sherrill, welcome. Did you forget?
A work meeting ran long and I was caught up in it and I completely forgot. So I'm deeply apologetic.
That's okay.
The climate movement waits for nobody, including me. So I apologize to you and your listeners.
No worries at all. I'm glad you're here and I'm glad everything's okay. So Daniel Sherrill, you are, is it Sherrill? Is that how I pronounce your name?
Sherrill. Bell.
Like yeah. Bell. Sherrill. Daniel yeah. Sherrill. And you're a climate activist. This is what, so that's what you, the field you work in as well. That's not part of the book.
It is a part of the book.
Oh, it is part
through.
Of the book.
But yeah, this is what I've been doing with the better part of the last decade of my life. I can't imagine doing anything more important.
Uh-huh.
And it feels like, I think I've, somebody the other day referred to climate activism as my passion, and I don't think of it that way. It feels more like fighting a fire in my house, and that's not a passion. That's just something you have to do.
Right. This is your life. I mean, here's the thing. You were born in 1990. After my generation and even those who came before me fucked up the planet, right? We left you with this planet that's burning to the point where you wrote a book, and the book takes the form of a letter to your as yet future child, and you call it Warmth, Coming of Age at the End of Our World. I'm kind of surprised to hear you say that. I'm a cynic. But I'm older. I've lived through this. I saw my generation screw everything up. But I've often believed in the last couple of years, I've had a horrible thought that I don't know why anyone would want to bring a new baby into this world, knowing that a child born today, say 25 years from now, what this planet is going to look like if we don't fix things, and there's no indication we're fixing anything. We're already seeing the horrific effects of climate change on our lives. I can't imagine what it's going to be like 25 years from now. So to birth a child into this, I think, is highly irresponsible. But that's me, and I'm not having any more kids. So, but is this how you feel? Is that what prompted you to write this book?
I think a question similar to that, but okay. I want to caveat the first from the get-go that I'm not a fatalist.
Okay.
The climate crisis is extremely dire, and we have a lot of work to do to dig ourselves out of the hole we've left ourselves in, but our fate is not sealed. And I think based on the actions we take literally in the next two decades, mm-hmm. we could see a swath of outcomes from 2 degrees Celsius of warming, which is very bad and causes lots of wildfires and floods and et cetera. But the basis of civilization doesn't crumble, or we can see 4 or 5 degrees Celsius of warming. And that is a point where we just don't have enough food or water to
right.
maintain the population on planet Earth. And that's sort of why I engage in this work, because it's not like nuclear war. It's not a binary problem. Somebody presses the button or they don't, and the missile fires, boom, we're done. There's a massive gradation of outcomes here. And every tick we bring the thermometer down is equivalent to literally millions of lives saved. So in fact, there's an incredible moral gravity and even honor, I think, to engaging the climate crisis. And for those people who feel cynical, who feel jaded, who feel like their generation fucked up,
yeah.
First of all, I want to tell you, no, that's an oversimplification. There are people in your generation.
That's true.
There are fossil fuel executives
yep.
who knew about climate change in the 70s and buried the information so they could still keep making money hand over fist.
Mm-hmm.
It was sociopathic behavior. I really think that's what it is. And I think we've created corporate structures that self-select for sociopaths. But for most ordinary folk, they were going about living their lives. They wanted to put food on the table. They wanted to go on vacation. They wanted a loving, happy family. Not to let people off the hook, but I think starting from a place of this is my fault, woe is me, is a very bad place to start.
Right. No, I'm not saying it's my fault. I'm saying the generation. Look, people point to the baby boomers. I'm at the tail end of the baby boom. So I have to take some ownership of it. I lived through it, and I lived a life of excess as well. Big cars, lots of gas, airplane flights. We didn't really think about it. And it was, I remember, I think it was the first big Earth Day celebration. It was when we finally started paying attention to it. This had to be, probably the late 80s, early 90s. And, but still nobody took it seriously. It's like, that's off in the future. Everything's always off in the future. Well, then I remember years later, the formation of the organization 350.org. And they talked about when we get to 350 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere, basically we're fucked. And not in a good way. We're screwed. This is going to be bad. There may be that's the point of no return. Well, we're over 400 now. So how much worse can it get when we can still turn it around? Can we still turn it around?
I think we can, and it's morally incumbent on us to try. And it can get a lot worse.
Yeah.
But the beauty of trying to curb our emissions is that in the process, we're going to have to create a more just and equitable society. Because if we continue promulgating policies that essentially throw poor people under the bus for the sake of corporate profit, then we're all going down in flames. The CEOs might be last, but they're coming down with us. They live on this planet too.
Right.
So it will force us to reorder society in a way that finally honors the dignity and humanity of all people, which is another reason I'm motivated to engage in this movement. But you asked me why I wrote the book.
Yeah.
And I think it was two things. I mean, when I started putting pen to paper, and I didn't intend to write a book. This book started as like notes I tapped out to myself on my iPhone on the subway to work. Because at that point I'd been doing climate work for about 7 or 8 years, and I'd been in the trenches of email and conference calls, and it's very fast paced. I was often running late to things, as I was today. Apologies.
Shit happens.
And I could feel like this knot of thought and feeling about the weight of the problem I was grappling with sort of tightening in my chest. But I had no room to unspool that. And at a certain point, I intuited that if I didn't take some time to actually feel my feelings around climate change and negotiate a real encounter with it as a thing that was happening to all of us currently, rather than an abstract set of data I saw in the news sometimes, I wouldn't be able to continue this work for the rest of my life, which is my plan.
Right.
I started to tap out these notes, and pretty soon my thoughts turned to like my potential children. I mean, for a while now, I've sort of intuited that I was excited about being a father. And also, as you say, that is a decision that felt deeply fraught, and I was very ambivalent about looking at the scientific projection for what we're going to see in the next century.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, writing this book was a kind of preparation. Writing my way through that ambivalence and sort of in a very practical way, if I was ever going to bring anybody into this world, I had to give them something, some letter, some document, some conversation starter that could put us in communication about the situation they'd been brought into against their will, not against their will, but without their consent. And then if I wasn't prepared to have that conversation and have it openly and vulnerably, then I would never be able to start a family. That was a prerequisite.
But, you know, just as an aside, you can still have a family without bringing another life into the world. I'm a mother through adoption. I adopted
absolutely
my daughter.
True.
She was already a human being, already here on the planet. I went to Kazakhstan to find her and bring her home. But, I didn't bring another life into this world, which is what really freaks me out right now. And I'm sure that's my thing. And millions of people are still having babies every day. But I hope those who are conflicted, it's like, I don't want to bring another life into this crazy with what's coming. There are children who have already been born or are being born who do not necessarily have a loving family who need one. And so it's the best of both worlds, or, you know. Anyway, that's just something out there. You don't have to bring a life into the world to be a parent.
Yeah, I grapple with adoption in the book. And I think, frankly, at this point, it's the most ethically defensible option.
I think so, too. And it's wonderful. Just for those who wonder, I couldn't be any more my daughter's mother if she had, come out of me. She is my kid in every possible way, shape, and form. So it is nurture over nature, I think. So anyway, so this is something you grapple with, so the book became this letter to this person who may or may not be part of your future. One of the things that, and I'm not that far into it, just so you know, I get a lot of books and I read as much as I can before the interview
comes.
I'm
sure you do. Yeah.
I appreciate that you refer to climate change, not as climate change, but the problem with a capital P. Where did that come from?
I think even as a climate change activist, I think more and more as the years went by, every time I heard the word climate change, I would notice myself sort of pigeonholing it into a very narrow discursive box.
Uh-huh.
This was this far off problem. It was scientific. It was bureaucratic. It was technocratic. It was quote unquote a current event. It was something happening in the atmosphere of the news, but it wasn't a thing I could grapple with directly. And I was sort of dissatisfied with climate change discourse. it was often talked about as an environmental issue. And I felt again that that sort of really minimized the scale of what we're talking about and the fact that it really is going to impact every single aspect of our lives over the next century. It felt more to me like an ontological or a metaphysical problem than an environmental one strictly. So I wanted with this book to break it out of that box. I think it's a box we keep it in because we're scared a little bit, maybe in the back of our minds. It's a way of compartmentalizing it. But I actually think that compartmentalization is something really dangerous. Because eventually the climate change is going to, if you put it in a cognitive compartment, it is going to break out of that compartment. We've seen it with the floods in Germany.
Oh, sure. It's affecting every aspect of our lives. And depending where on the planet you are, some places it's already hitting much harder than others. You mentioned the floods in Germany and everything. It's nonstop. And so bigger than, you know, it was global warming. Then the idiots on Fox are going, but it's snowing. So, all right, it's climate change. But you are saying it's bigger than that. It's the problem with a capital P.
Yeah. And it's something I think I wanted to allow my readers and allow myself to, again, encounter, to defamiliarize it and then encounter it on its own terms rather than through all the cultural media filters we've used to try to like force this back into its compartment because it's too scary and it's too big. I actually think that's an unsustainable cognitive strategy. At least for me, it has been immensely, I don't want to say healing because we're still in the thick of this crisis, but it's been deeply meaningful to me to like go through that emotional and intellectual processing and develop my own relationship to the climate crisis rather than sort of imbibe this like scary but kind of inarticulate version that gets fed to me through the news. And I think people are scared of that genuine encounter because they're scared of what it's going to look like when they open that Pandora's box, because it is our situation. Truly, it's hard to imagine something more dire and more urgent and, you know, that is already happening. But for me, at least, doing the work to take it out of its box and really grapple with it on an emotional level has made me feel more prepared for the century ahead, not less.
Cool. So, you know, we've only got 3 minutes left. What can we do to prepare for this? I mean, what should we be doing? I mean, we've already heard, you know, get rid of the gas guzzlers. I don't know if going to electric cars is going to make that big a difference because it's still powered by electricity, and most electricity is still, I think, still coal burning plants, isn't it?
Yeah. No.
No.
In the U.S., it's mostly natural gas at this point.
But well, I would say gas, still bad.
It's that's not good either.
No.
What I would say is, forget the demand side solutions.
Okay.
We are not going to consume our way towards salvation on the climate crisis. You can buy the right products and etc. You can eat less meat. You can take more public transit, and all of that is important and noble, and you should do it. But we've been tricked, I think, by the fossil fuel industry into thinking this is on us. Right.
Right.
In fact, their very business model, no matter the consumption choices we make, is sending us on a road to perdition, very literally. And they are clinging to that business model with all of their political might, which is considerable because they're the richest industry to ever exist on the planet. So when you think about what you need to do to take action on the climate crisis, this is not, you are not just an individual consumer in capitalism. You are part of a democratic country. And our duty above all else is to build enough political power that we can discipline and regulate into the ground those fossil fuel executives that would send us towards apocalypse and the politicians they've bought. So I think, I'm not saying this is an either or, but I think we have to flip the paradigm in the way Americans talk about climate change. This isn't about screwing in the right light bulb. It's not even about driving the right car, although those things are important. That's about joining with your fellow citizens in a social movement to reorder who's making decisions at the highest level. And if it's the fossil fuel executives and their purchased politicians making decisions, then we really are screwed. So we have to wrest the helm from them.
Daniel Sherrill is his name. The book is Warmth: Coming of Age at the End of Our World. Daniel, I want to put you in touch with a friend who's a listener who's in the chat room on YouTube now. She's under the name of Environmental Coffee House, and she does a show on YouTube dealing with exactly what you're dealing with, and you'd be great for her show. So I want to get you two together. So if you could hold on just a minute and maybe I can get your information and send it to her or vice versa, that would be great because this conversation needs to continue and that's a perfect place to do it. The book sounds great. I'm going to finish reading it. I look forward to it. Thank you for doing it. And thank you for making this your life's work because it's up to you guys. and all of us too. So Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Hold on a moment. I'm going to wrap this thing up and then I'm going to come to you. So stand by. With that, we're done for today. Tomorrow is Thursday. Howie Klein will be here and we got a lot to talk about, including what happened in Ohio yesterday. All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. I will see you tomorrow. I will leave you with the news.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The independent investigation has concluded that Governor Andrew Cuomo sexually harassed multiple women and in doing so violated federal and state law.
That is New York Attorney General Letitia James on Tuesday giving the results of an investigation into charges of sexual harassment levied against New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, finding that he sexually harassed 11 women and created a hostile work environment for women.
The investigators independently corroborated and substantiated these facts through interviews and evidence, including contemporaneous notes and communications. This evidence will be made available to the public along with the report. This investigation was started after a number of women publicly alleged that they had been sexually harassed by Governor Cuomo. And on March 1st of this year, the governor's office made a referral to my office pursuant to State Executive Law 63-8 regarding these allegations.
Investigators said they found a pattern of inappropriate behavior by Cuomo, which included both unwanted touching and comments of a suggestive and sexual nature. Cuomo denies the allegations and has shown no willingness to resign over them. Well, as we reported yesterday, the federal moratorium on evictions expired Saturday night. But that changed on Tuesday when the Centers for Disease Control announced a new eviction moratorium covering areas with high coronavirus transmission rates. The policy will last for 60 days. Progressive Democrats in Congress levied harsh criticism against President Biden for letting the original moratorium expire, although the president said a June Supreme Court decision required action from Congress to extend the ban. Freshman Congresswoman Cori Bush of St. Louis slept on the Capitol steps in protest for four nights, vowing not to leave until a new moratorium was in place. When word of the new policy came down, Bush was joined on the steps by a number of Democratic senators for thanks and congratulations. The new eviction freeze affects counties where the CDC has recommended that even vaccinated people wear masks indoors. The areas covered are home to 90% of the U.S. population. Biden acknowledged that even a limited freeze could face court challenges, but the legal process would provide time to get emergency assistance to millions of people in danger of losing their homes. But down here in what's now considered the epicenter of the COVID outbreak in the U.S., Florida Governor Ron DeSantis doubled down on his opposition to mask and vaccine mandates. Florida had 11,515 patients hospitalized for COVID on Tuesday, setting a record for the third straight day. That figure was just 1,000 in June. DeSantis blamed the surge of infections on hot weather that has forced Floridians inside instead of the probable culprits, insufficient mask wearing and vaccinations. President Biden criticized DeSantis and other officials resisting new mandates, saying, quote, if you're not going to help, at least get out of the way of people trying to do the right thing. The Biden administration plans to start offering coronavirus vaccines to migrants in U.S. custody along the Mexican border. The migrants reportedly will get the single-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine, avoiding the difficulty of arranging a second shot. New policy in New York City, as people will be required to prove they have received at least one vaccine dose before they can eat indoors at a restaurant, enter a gym, or go into a theater. This new program is called Key to NYC Pass. It'll start on a voluntary basis on August 16th, with enforcement beginning in mid-September. People will be able to show their vaccine status using a paper CDC vaccine card or an existing vaccine passport app. A couple of special primary elections in Ohio on Tuesday with surprising outcomes. In the 11th district, Bernie Sanders' surrogate, progressive Nina Turner, suffered a brutal loss to Chantel Brown. The Cuyahoga County Councilwoman had massive support from the establishment wing of the Democratic Party, with James Clyburn, Hillary Clinton, and the Congressional Black Caucus all offering massive support, ensuring their win in the latest grudge match between the conservative and progressive wings of the Democratic Party. Brown will go up against the Republican nominee Laverne Gore in the general election in November. In the 15th congressional district, a coal lobbyist, Mike Carey, won the Republican primary for a vacant House seat there. Carey had the backing of the former guy, who was running in a crowded field of candidates. But Carey got 36% of the vote to second place Bob Peterson's 14%. And finally, Ipsos, the polling company, asked an unvaccinated polling sample who they blamed for the current spread of COVID. 37% said people traveling from other countries to the U.S. 27% blamed the mainstream media. 23% blamed Americans traveling abroad. 21% blamed Joe Biden. And 10% of them blamed the unvaccinated. I think we need to get 90% of them a mirror. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener-supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.